Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Julia Lee, Professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Irvine, and your host for today's show. My guest today is Mimi Cook. Mimi is a PhD, writer, scholar, and teacher of things unwell. She is currently the co-editor of the Asian American Literary Review and an adjunct lecturer in disability studies at Georgetown University. Her work includes Open in Emergency, a hybrid book arts project decolonizing Asian American mental health, the Asian American Tarot, a reimagined deck of tarot cards, and the Open in Emergency Initiative, an ongoing national project developing mental health arts programming with universities and community spaces. Her new creative critical genre-bending book on mental health and a pedagogy of unwellness, Dear Elia, Letters from the Asian American Abyss, published by Duke University Press, is a journey into the depths of Asian American unwellness at the intersections of ableism, model minoritization, and the university, and an exploration of new approaches to building collective care. That collective care is based on a premise that most of us probably do not want to accept, that we are all differentially unwell. That the dream of productivity, upward mobility, health, and progress depends on a crushing kind of conformity to rules that we are told are achievable and natural, but only if we work really, really hard. If we fail to live up to that dream, it's because of some failure on our part. Dear Elia rejects this notion and asks, what would happen if instead of constantly looking inward to explain our perceived lack, we examined and then rebuilt the structures that judged us in the first place? Mimi focuses her critique on institutions like the mental health profession, colleges and universities, and the professoriate, but she also turns a loving but critical eye on Asian American studies in its institutional forms and its uneasy relationship to academia, which demands certain types of knowledge production, and the university, which demands certain types of power relations. In asking the reader to reconsider issues related to wellness and unwellness, the book is powerfully advocating for a different type of pedagogy, both in the classroom and out, one that emphasizes mutual care and self-processing in order to save all of our lives. Mimi, welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. That was such a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Thank you. So I want to ask, I want to start actually by asking you to share with our listeners the story of how your book came into being. So what were some of the key events that led to Dear Elia?
Sure. I love stories. I love telling stories. So I will tell the story of the origins of Dear Elia, which involved telling the story of the origins of Open in Emergency, my kind of precursor mental health project. So as you mentioned, Open Emergency is a hybrid book arts project, which is like fancy words for it's stuff and not a book. It's a box with five parts, and it's a kind of co-curated collective project, arts project that tries to find new language for Asian American unwellness, Asian American pain, Asian American suffering, because I was finding it very limited in like you mentioned, psychology, psychiatry, for instance, the kind of psychological language around mental health, and even the language in Asian American studies, I didn't think fully was capturing the experiences of Asian Americans in terms of their mental health. And so Open Marginally came out in 2016, and I started this project. It has some personal roots. I had experienced postpartum depression after having my daughter, whose name is Elia, the name on the title of my book. And I struggled to find language around why my life felt so fucking shitty, right? Is it because I'm a bad mother? That's what everyone was telling me. That's what the world is telling me, right? I'm a bad mother. That's why I don't love motherhood, apparently. And I wasn't finding joy and all the things you're supposed to find, meaning. And that felt very unsatisfying as a narrative for why things felt so awful. I found the language of postpartum depression. That was helpful. But I also realized that Asian American studies, the fields that I was trained in, Asian American studies, gender and feminist studies, were telling me that there are actually structural forces that shape how I feel as well. So I started bridging those things with my experiences. Meanwhile, I was teaching Asian American studies to undergraduate students at the University of Maryland, and I was watching so many of my Asian American students struggle, and sometimes to the point of death, right? Asian Americans have some of the highest rates of suicidal ideation. And I realized that what we're doing in the classroom needs to actually reflect that. It needs to reflect what the students are experiencing and give them tools to figure out what they're experiencing and to figure it out together and to build different things for our survival. So, fast forward, Open Emergency was an attempt to answer that question. Like, what is Asian American suffering? What hurts? And then how do we go on living while it hurts? And I asked, like, everybody and their mother, right, to contribute to this project. There are like 80 contributors to the project. But people who are not normally considered mental health experts, right? When we say mental health experts, we usually think of psychiatrists, psychologists, and various psychotherapists. And I wanted to ask artists, writers, humanities scholars, survivors, community members, and see what they thought, what hurts, and how have they been dealing with what hurts. And the answers I got were incredibly rich and stunning and came out in the form of tarot cards and original tarot cards that I curated. We created our own DSM, which is the Diagnostical Manual of Mental Disorders, the psychiatric Bible. We said, what if we made an Asian American one? And then what if we hacked it? And letters and info medical brochures. So I try to find these different forms to ask and answer this question. Fast forward now. Open Emergency went out into the world and did all kinds of things that I had no idea it would do. So it's been taught in, I don't know, hundreds of classrooms at this point. Students were really responded to it. And then I began to be invited places to come talk about mental health, to do workshops. So I actually started what I call now my mental health tour. So for the past 7 years, I've been going around to so many universities and so many community spaces and talking with people about mental health, sharing Open Emergency, activating it in the world, having people engage its materials, but also listening and learning even more about what unwellness looks like, especially for students. And so Dear Elia, my book project, is a deepening of the work in a new form. So Open Emergency began asking the questions and offered some new language and some new approaches. And I decided, encouraged by my editor at Duke, to deepen that work in book form. And I had to be encouraged because I was wary of the book as a form for doing this, which is why Open Emergency is not a book in the first place. I was wary of the academic book in particular. And so I thought, if I'm going to do a book, I have to do a book in a way that thinks very intentionally about its form and doesn't just fall into like the genre of academic writing, right? Because academic writing for me so far had not served me in helping myself or helping my students understand unwellness. And so what are the other forms that I could do that still could like fit in a book, right? Not a box, a book now with a cover, right? But could I still play with that? Could I still figure out how to make that form do the work of authorizing non-experts like open emergency, asking and answering new questions with new language, and then also activating in the world? So, like, engaging people, engaging the reader in different ways. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And actually, you know, one of the things, there are a couple of things that struck me about your book as I was reading it. First is like your how you center pedagogy, like students, how you really center the experience of particularly students, undergraduate students. Lots of scholarly books have pedagogy, right, in their titles. But this was for me a very different, this was entirely student-centered kind of approach. And then the other thing was the form and your inclusion of colleagues and fellow adjuncts and the voices of undergraduates and other students. I mean, it was really incredible to me. And the fact that you open the book very clearly saying this is not an academic book. It looks like an academic book, maybe, right? Duke University Press and all those things, but it's not an academic book. And so I thought that was interesting, like that opening list of things that this book is not. And then also the opening is a letter, right, to your daughter. And so why did you want to have those? I mean, you kind of answered that first question a little bit, but I'm curious about the form of the letter, which takes, you know, which happens throughout that first chapter, through that first chapter of the book. Why those two kind of juxtapose together?
I started thinking about the letter as a form in Open Emergency. So my editor's note actually is in a letter to my daughter Elia at the time as well. And thinking of Open Emergency as a gift to her to help her find the tools to survive the awfulness of the world. Right. And those were felt like the stakes for me as I was doing this project. So not only trying to save my own life, save my students' lives, but recognizing now that my daughter is going to go into the world that is also really fucked up for her and will harm her in all kinds of ways. What tools can I give her to help her move through that? So open emergency was the first step in doing that. The book felt like a continuation of that. And so I wanted to open with a letter to her again. Also, now the book is named after her. But I also wanted to structure the entire book as letters. So, yes, the first chapter has a bunch of different letters to my partner, Lawrence Minbui Davis, to the reader. But also, some of the letters are in the other chapters are dedicated to, written to students, written to my colleagues, written to teachers. And I did this because the letter to me is an intimate form. Right? It allows for feeling work to happen, but also it breaks the illusion of the universal objective reader and audience, right? Like we write letters to someone. There is a very particular audience when we write a letter, and there are stakes in writing that letter, right? You write a letter to someone because there's something you have to say. There are personal stakes. There's something you want them to hear or something you want them to respond to. And it makes the reader also feel like they have a stake in this conversation. And so academic books are usually written with a kind of universal you, which is not a universal person at all, right? Like most people cannot read an academic book. So that is definitely already not a universal person that's accessing academic books. But like, is there really an objective universal reader for anything, right? And so thinking about my book as a letter allowed me to really focus on who I'm talking to, what I want them to hear, or what I want us to figure out together, and what the stakes are for somebody engaging the book, right? Why does this matter to somebody? Why do I want someone to read the book? Why do I want them to do the activities in it? Why do I want them to reflect on the questions I'm asking or the stories of students? There's reasons for each of those things, right? And so the letter for me does that work, I think. Hopefully, in a way that the genre of academic writing can't. Now, I start the book, like you said, saying the things that it's not. Like I say, it's not a tenure book. It's not a traditional academic scholarly book. It doesn't follow the genre. Yes, it's published by Duke, which makes it look like an academic book, which is actually important to me, right? Because I am engaging intellectual questions and engaging scholarship and engaging fields. like Asian American studies, like disability studies, like critical university studies. But I wanted to be very clear from the start for the reader that we're going to engage those fields in a very different way, because I didn't want readers to come into the book seeing that it's published by Duke University Press, assuming the genre, assuming the work is going to do the things, the book is going to do the things that they expect an academic book to do. I had to be very clear that this is intentionally not that. So they wouldn't bring their baggage, right, to the book, and their ideas, especially about rigor. Like, what counts as rigor? I feel like there are people who would fight me to the death, right, about what counts as rigor, how we define it, why it matters. I'm sure I disagree with most people about what counts as rigor. And so this book names that, right, by saying it's not a tenure book, not a scholarly book. I'm going to actually do something rigorous in a totally different way than you expect it to do. And I hope that starting off that way allows people to enter the work with more of an open mind, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. And in fact, I think it's interesting because approaching the book, as you describe, like kind of like the reader approaching the book with this open mind, I think your writing very quickly makes clear what the baggage is. Like, even if the reader thinks, oh, I don't have it, or I'm, you know, what baggage, you know? Your words, the way you set up the book, make that impossible to continue to think that like that way. So I actually, you know, I appreciated the fact that you included some of the prompts that you've used in your workshops and in your talks, and you actually give the reader space in your book, right, to write his, her, their own ideas, right? You have this very kind of very, I think very effective pedagogical voice where you're like, go ahead and do it for 5 minutes. I'll be here. You know, don't skip ahead. Like, just go ahead and try it and we can go from there. So it felt very, it felt like classroom in the best kind of way, like intimate in that.
Oh, sense. I love that. Thank you.
Yeah. So, but I'm curious about that because, you know, I want to talk about form because I really found this interesting.
Yeah.
You include a lot of things that I think most of us would consider to be ephemeral, like social media posts, or you actually have images of the whiteboards that you filled in during some of your visits with undergraduates or adjunct lecturers. You have annotated syllabi, your own syllabi, right, from pre-pandemic, and then how you change things after the pandemic. So, and you also, your citational practice is really community-based, I would say, because you cite, you do the sort of scholarly citations, but you also make clear, like, these are my interlocutors. These are the folks that I've been in conversation with over the last, and their words, whether published or not, have impacted my thinking on this in these kinds of ways. So it's very processual, I think, very process-oriented. So I was struck, A, that you kind of want to insert that community experience or that materiality or that lived-in experience in your writing. Was that always the way it was going to be? Or, you know, when you were thinking about it, were you like, yes, I'm going to include my social media posts, I'm going to include pictures of whiteboards, I'm going to include, you know, surveys that I filled out, Google Docs, like, or did that come later in the writing and revision process for you?
That's such a fun question, because it makes me sound like I'm very like intentional and I plan things out really well. But no, I didn't actually. A lot of that came about as I was writing, because these were the texts that made sense to explain the thing that I was explaining, right? And I love you calling them ephemeral. These texts, the ones you're pointing out, especially like a whiteboard and a social media post. Well, maybe not the social media, but they can live forever. But a whiteboard doesn't live forever, right? And what does it mean to try to capture something like that and recognize that something ephemeral like that captures something important, right? And so thank you for pointing that out. That really helps me actually think about why I look at the kind of sites that I look at, because they're filled with feeling. Right, all this feeling work that is happening that isn't captured in usual texts, and so why not? Why not include them? So yeah, I included lots of things from students. Like you said, the book is very student oriented. I sometimes think of the book as a love letter to students as well. Students who have taught me so much about teaching and have taught me so much about unwellness, and who have helped me actually find so much language around unwellness. And so the book is definitely for students, and I hope students read it, and I hope they really see themselves in it. And they are kind of my, I have many audiences in mind, but they're definitely my main audience in mind because I want them to save their own lives with the book. Now, my citational practice also, I would say that's part intentional and part developed as I was writing. Yes, I did feel compelled sometimes to do like academic footnotes, right? With like, let me list all the things that I've read so I can prove to you that I'm rigorous and done research. And once in a while, I did feel compelled to do that, but I tried to actively resist it, actually, because that is not the only way I've known things and I've learned things. And you're right, I have learned things through relationships and through talking with people. Again, ephemera, right? I've learned things through moments that aren't captured in publications, academic publications that take like 5 years to come out, right? Like there are other ways that knowledge happens. And it feels really important. Just as Open Emergency was a communal collective project, this book, even as a monograph with my name on it as a sole author, is still a communal collective project because I've done so much thinking in spaces with community, with loved ones. And so, yes, people will find their names scattered randomly through the footnotes that probably didn't expect to find their names there, because we once had a conversation about something, or we've had a ongoing text thread for years, right, about something, and that has been a space that helped me understand something differently.
That's
I
really
always say, I say there's two ways to end up in my work. Either I love you so much, or you fucked me over. Those are the two ways to end up in my writing.
We're going to talk about that latter way in a minute, but yeah. I was really struck by kind of also how you talk about workshops you participated in or panels where, round tables where, and in fact, the idea for tarot, I think you said, came from like not a panel at AAAS, right? The Association for Asian American Studies conference, but like in the hallway that our colleague Long Bui was doing tarot readings, right? I think that's right. And so
It was drunk happy hour, right, at an academic conference. That is when the fun stuff happens.
But that is also when the really generative stuff happens, right? That's when you
Exactly.
can see in this sort of like, I think you say interstitial spaces, right? Outside of these kinds of more institutionalized, public facing gatherings, right? That this other kind of work can kind of happen and be really impactful. So can I ask you to explain what you mean by pedagogy of unwellness? What does that mean?
Yes. I came up with this term because first I'm going to actually explain unwellness, then I'll explain pedagogy of unwellness. Because I've been asked before, why do you use the term unwellness and what does that mean for you? And I like to say that I have no problem with the word illness personally. I identify as an ill person or a chronically ill person. But I find that the word illness comes with a lot of baggage for most people. It's pathologized, right? And it also draws on a medical model that I'm very, very suspicious of, the medical model of health or of mental health that looks at individual pathology that then is individually cured, right? That's usually how things happen when you go to the doctor. And so I did not want to bring that framework with me when thinking about mental health, because I wanted to locate mental health in structures and not just individual people with individual problems. And so unwellness felt much more capacious as a term. We all use the word. We all at some point say, I feel unwell. And we all mean actually very different things when we use that term. And so it felt like a way to capture what hurts, which is my question all the time, right? In the kind of broadest range possible, but also from like the worst catastrophes in our your fucking life to like something really mundane and banal in your day that makes you feel like crap, right? A headache, something small. And so I wanted something to capture all of that because all of that is shaped by structure. It's not just an individual experience. So pedagogy of unwellness is my way of thinking about how unwellness exists in the world. And I realized it exists in our world everywhere for everybody, and that maybe we are all actually unwell. And when I started thinking that through, that made so much sense to me, right? We are all dealing with shit at any given moment, all the time. And so what does it mean to then assume unwellness? What does it mean to recognize that we're all unwell? And then what do our classrooms have to look like then? What do our workplaces have to look like? What do our homes and families have to look like if we're all assuming that we're all unwell and we all need and deserve care? So a pedagogy of unwellness recognizes that we're all unwell and then points us towards collective care, like you mentioned, right? Points us towards, well, if we're all unwell, then we all need care and not sometimes, not some of us some of the time, which is how we tend to think about illness, right? But all of us all the time in different ways and in all the spaces that we move in.
That was really helpful for me, actually, because I, you know, illness for me sounds acute, right? It sounds like a one-time,
yeah.
It sounds like it's sort of bounded in time and space. And what I'm hearing or what I'm getting from you in your book is this idea of actually it is, it encompasses every aspect of our life. Like you cannot constrain unwellness to just a particular moment or a particular, like 2 or 3 days, right? There's something,
right, whatever your sick leave is.
Yeah, exactly, right? Or yeah, however much sick leave or maternity leave, whatever family leave you get. Mm-hmm. So it's a condition that is temporally unbound, right? It's like completely, there are no limits to it. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we are all unwell, right, and telling ourselves various versions of, oh no, I'm fine, right, or I'm okay, I think was really powerful, at least for me, like understanding that or being able to understand that was really, really important. So I want to talk about colleges and universities now. And again, this was really helpful to me because I realized, oh, I'm doing this in my classroom. I do it quite a bit. So this was like a come to Jesus moment of like, I need to say that. You talk about how statistics around Asian American mental health, right? High rates of suicide ideation, like that suicide for Asian Americans between the ages of like 18 to 24. Suicide is the leading cause of death, right, for Asian Americans between the ages of 15 to 24, that these statistics are used primarily like in pedagogical settings to deny model minority narratives, right? We can't be the model minority. Look at how much pain we're collectively in. So I have often done that, right? I cite those statistics as a way of countering that destructive narrative. But I think what's important about what you're doing is you're asking, why is this age group so vulnerable or so prone, right, to this kind of suicidal ideation, to this idea, to pain, to hurting, right? And what are they all doing at around that time period? Where are a lot of them going?
In college,
or they're trying to get into college, right? Or they're trying to get the after effects of college. So you're asking us, as you said, to look at wellness as sort of a structural issue, right? Structural violence. And if we do that, then we have to look at colleges and universities, right? As not the solution to that, but actually a driver of it. And this was what was really like shifted my thinking, I think, quite a bit. So how is that possible? How are institutions of higher education not just implicated in unwellness, but actually like the source of unwellness?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling that a come to Jesus moment. That's amazing. Yeah. And I like the way you frame that in terms of thinking possibly before that universities and higher education are ways out of unwellness. I want to think about that assumption that we're making, right? And yes, and then I'm arguing that actually universities are unwellness machines. They actually create so much unwellness. In terms of the Asian American stats, I mean, I cite them too, but I started thinking about, like you said, why? What makes life feel so unbearable? And here I'm inspired by Erin Ng's work, right? Where she asks, what is unbearable about a life that looks like straight A's and perfectly normal and banal and going to school and maybe, be going to med school, becoming a doctor, like all the things are the American dream, right? What is unbearable about that? And it's actually, that's the actual question and answer too. The American dream is unbearable. The idea that we have to, like you say, work hard and that working hard will get you what you want and need, that's meritocracy, right? And that the way to do it is through what I call compulsory wellness and hyperproductivity. So the university's main values actually are compulsory wellness and hyperproductivity. So by that, I mean productivity to extreme levels, but also tied to our sense of ourselves and value in ourselves. So we are valued because we are productive, because we're good workers, we're good citizens, because we achieve things. That's how we value ourselves, how we value each other. Now, compulsory wellness is related to that. The idea that we're supposed to be well. So like, I know this is jarring for a lot of people because they're like, isn't wellness good? But if you are forced to pretend that you are well all the time, right? And what does wellness look like? I mentioned sick days earlier. Wellness looks like the ability to work, right? The binary between sick and well or ill and well requires, like you're saying, that temporal boundary. That sometimes you're sick, most of the time you're supposed to be well. And how do we determine that? Oh, the days you can work, right? Those are the days you're well. And the days you can't work, those are the days you're sick. And so there's this, and talking to students makes this very clear that they are not allowed to say that things are hard or that they're struggling. They do not have that permission because you are penalized, right? If you are struggling, it's your fault that you're struggling. It's not the system's fault. It's not the structures around you that are abandoning you. It's your fault. And that is so strong in schools, right? So actually, education for me is one of the biggest systems of imparting meritocracy and valuing yourself through achievement. Because what is school but like not a system of trying to achieve and being judged and evaluated by your achievements at every step of the way? So like, how can we be well in that kind of space, right? That asks us to pretend we're not well all the time, that makes us produce and achieve and then judge ourselves and each other, and then abandons us if we don't meet those standards. Like, that is not a system that actually is one of care at all, even as universities love to say that they care about students and faculty, and that they, support and nurture wellness. Wellness actually is now like a buzzword at every university now. There are so, right? There are wellness programs, wellness initiatives, wellness days. And it's, for me, it's such a fucking farce because it's a co-optation of wellness, the language of wellness, to make better workers, right? People take care of themselves so that they can work more, so that they can go back to work. Or the other way, people work hard to earn the ability to rest or take care of themselves. It's always tied to work.
I was just thinking when you were talking, come to a workshop on wellness.
Yes.
But let's have another meeting or let's add something to your calendar to be able to talk about wellness. Whereas I'm like, why don't you just give everybody the day off to do what they
Right.
do? Yeah.
Right. Why not cancel at all the meetings
Right.
as a form of care? No,
Right.
because that makes the institution not function, right?
Right.
So
Right.
it can't, that can't happen as a form of care.
You know, one of the ways that I see this when you're talking about students in particular in the classroom is, and the way that we individuate sort of blame, right, responsibility is the student who has missed, assignments or not done some work. And then you find they, they tell you much later, or, after the quarter, whenever, oh, I was going through this really terrible thing, personal thing or health related thing. And the first response is always, well, why didn't you, tell me? Why didn't you communicate with your TA? Why didn't you do, I do this too, right? But and listening to you talk, I realize they don't feel like they have a voice, like that's not an option to them. Like,
it's not an option.
I think faculty instructors are often like, why don't students do this thing that seems really obvious? But of course, that obvious is if you're in the system. Do you know what I mean? Like, to them, obvious because they don't have the space or they're not given the tools like to understand, oh, actually, I can express something here. Instead, it's like, I just have to be quiet and, flunk or, whatever it is, whatever the outcome is, I just have to accept it. So, I think that's one like really concrete moment when I was reading and when you were talking where I was like, oh, I see where that shows up in this very kind of in this small way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The students don't feel like they can tell their professors, one, because professors are always assuming students are lying. This constant need for documentation, right? This constant need for proof and to adjudicate whether a need is good enough for the excuse that you're, the exception that you're asking for, right? And so students don't want to be judged by professors. They don't want to, they're forced to parade out their traumas and their pain to let somebody else say whether that's good enough that for you to be, for it's okay for you to miss class that day, right? They're punished no matter what. They're punished for missing class. They're punished for telling you why they miss class too. Maybe not you individually as a person, like lots of professors are very caring people, but the policies in place and the assumptions around wellness and unwellness, meaning like that students are supposed to be well, and that they work hard, they'll stay well, and that they're being unwell is an exception, only happens sometimes, right? If you assume that unwellness is happening all the time, because how can it not be? Student life is really, really hard. How can they not feel like shit a lot of the times, right? They're struggling in school. I'm sure their family lives are fucked, right? Their relationships are fucked, financially probably struggling as well. There are many days I don't want to work. When I'm teaching, there are many days I don't want to come to class. So of course there's going to be days that students don't want to come to class. The students don't feel able to do it, but they force themselves to do it because they'll be punished if they don't, right? If they're sick more than whatever, the three times they're allowed to miss class, the arbitrary number of three that people like, which is actually even generous because some people have like one as their number, but it's totally arbitrary. And students feel like they have to fit that mold. And they feel so much shame when they don't. They really internalize that it's their fault that things are hard and that they see their friends doing supposedly well because we're all pretending, right? We're all pretending we're doing well. We have our shit together and we're all achieving. And we're like competitively so. We're competitively achieving and competitively exhausted, like, right? We pretend that it's okay to be this exhausted. And then we have to compete who is more exhausted and who is more busy because that makes us more valuable. A better person. So they see their friends not admitting that they're unwell. How can they themselves then admit they're unwell and not it not be their own flaw, their own fault? It's deeply internalized. And professors do not make it safe to tell them otherwise.
Yeah. I want to turn to the chapter titled The Professor is Ill, right? And so that was a difficult chapter to read. For me personally. But in that chapter, you tell the story of your firing, which are your words, from the Asian American Studies program at the University of Maryland after many years, many, many years of service and labor, advising, teaching, program building. And it wasn't just you, I believe it was all the adjuncts in that program were fired at the same time. And what really struck me, there were many things that struck me about that chapter, but what really struck me was your sense, your articulation of your anger and your grief over your dismissal from this place that you had this really, this huge hand building, and that your partner, Lawrence, also had a huge hand in building. He was also dismissed. And that the grief and the anger that you were expressing were somehow viewed as unprofessional, right? And that's not how we behave in academic settings. That's not how we behave in professional settings. And you talk at length, it's quite painful to read about the mask that you feel like you have to put on, right, during some of those meetings, where you have to absorb administrative or faculty emotions without being able to express any yourself because you're in the position of that, you're the adjunct, right? So it did make me think about expressions of anger and grief and how women of color, Asian American women, marginalized folks are not allowed to express those kinds of feelings, or they're labeled as threatening or crazy or unprofessional, or, you know, there's a lot of vocabulary that we can call upon. So where does grief and or anger, like, where does that fit in to your thinking about pedagogies of unwellness? Like, do you see that connection? Where do you see that?
That's a great question. And thank you for being willing to talk about the chapter that is really harsh, I think, and will be very hard for a lot of academics.
We have to talk about it. I think you have to talk about it, you know.
So. Yeah. One small correction. So, yes, all the adjuncts were fired, but every single adjunct, except for me and Lawrence, were rehired the following semester.
Okay.
So actually weren't really fired, just me and Lawrence were fired. And like I say, I use the language of firing, but it's, you know, firing an adjunct just involves not renewing their contract. It's actually it's much easier to get rid of an adjunct in terms of policy, right? So then technically, is it really a firing? They just didn't get renewed, which is the terms of a adjunct contract. Yes. So I appreciate you recognizing and validating the pain that you read in that chapter, and recognizing that we're not allowed to usually express those kinds of things. And those things are pathologized in all the words that you used. And I have found that anger and grief actually are directly connected to a pedagogy of unwellness, because those are two feelings that are actually usually not allowed in what we call like respectable spaces, right? They go against respectability in so many ways. And Asian American professors in universities are working very hard to try to belong in a university that doesn't really want them, right? And so what does it mean to try to fit in into an institution? It's to then be respectable in that institution, right? And so no, we're not allowed to express things that are considered that go against ideas of what a good worker or a professional worker is supposed to look like, which is why I lean so hard into grief and anger, because I want to make space for those feelings that are not allowed. And they're not allowed for, I think, differentially. Like, some people are more allowed feelings than other people, depending on their positionality and their kind of structural location, and their social location, right? Oh, I lost my train of thought. Okay. okay. Some people are not allowed to feel those things. And for me as an adjunct, so most people listening probably know what an adjunct is, but some people might not, meaning somebody hired on contract, right? A contingent instructor. Contracts can be anywhere from one term to multiple terms, but usually they involve really, really shit pay and no or little benefits, and key, no guarantee of future employment, right? So as an adjunct, I'm like the bottom rung of instructors in the university, and I have to do certain kinds of emotional labor to get and keep my job. And I think I'm hoping that that is what was invisible before and becomes visible through the book, is that kind of emotional work, that I have to hide a lot of what I feel and that I have to take care of people's feelings who are located hierarchically above me in the system. This is true for any kind of hierarchy, right? But I think in academia, we are all colleagues and friends, and then we don't realize that the power structures our relationships as well, what it allows and what it doesn't allow. And I'm actually not sure why I was not rehired in the first place. That remains a mystery to me. I have speculation. I don't know why, but I definitely know why after I made a stink about it. Right? After I made a stink, meaning I was very angry, and I expressed that anger on social media, and I was in deep, deep grief about what I was losing, which felt like a home to me and to Lawrence, and friendships, right? Relationships that I was losing. And I have very little interest in respectability. So I'm like, I'm going to feel, and I'm going to tell people how I feel, and I'm going to demand that people make space for how I feel. And that's what this book, I hope, allows everybody to do, right? To have their full feelings, to feel like they're allowed to do that, to not be punished by that, and then to demand the care that those feelings require. And so that's what I did. Of course, that then got me in more trouble with the unit, where I basically got blacklisted and like publicly called a liar, right? Because I was doing things that demanded care that they did not want to provide, that broke social rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was painful for me because I am obviously faculty, I'm a faculty member, I'm a chair, I'm a part of the administration essentially to a certain extent. But you say at one point, oh, this is like something like a it feels like a tenure denial. This must be what a tenure denial is, right? And having undergone a tenure denial myself, I was like, yeah, I remember the feelings of I think I probably was not like you because I was like, move on, gotta keep going. And so, but it comes back. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like you're like, I've left that behind now. I don't have to feel that way ever again. Like those feelings are there. So it felt very, I recognized a lot of
Yeah.
what you were describing, right?
It's real loss, right? It's real loss, even if you do go on to do better things, right? Sometimes, people want to remind me that I've gone on from Maryland to do great things and that it was actually maybe too small of a space for me to kind of do the work that I want to do. Like I couldn't have done Open Emergency in the ways that I've done it, couldn't have written this book had I stayed there and been and continued to be contingent faculty there. Long-term contingent faculty there. But that I hate silver linings, right? They don't erase what was awful. And so you have to hold both of them at the same time. And I think pain requires that kind of witnessing and honoring. Grief requires that kind of witnessing and honoring. So yes, I hear you in terms of your tenure denial and like that doesn't go away just because now you are in a great position and doing great stuff now.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk to let's change the subject to another happy topic, which is the pandemic.
Okay.
So the narrative around the pandemic is that it forced instructors, right, to really change how we look at the classroom, like think about access, think about like the students. But it seems to me and to you too, right, that it just made all the things that already weren't working, like so glaringly obvious, like it was impossible to ignore anymore. So it was like a change in our perception as opposed to a change in like material reality for a lot of our students. So can you talk about the pandemic and how it has impacted, how it's impacted how you think about the classroom, the environment, how you think about your pedagogy?
Yeah, so as you know, I have a like gigantic monster of a chapter on pandemic and teaching, because the pandemic affected my teaching so much. And I wanted to write that down and show the process that unfolded as I was dealing with thinking about how the pandemic is affecting my students. So, like I said before, we without the pedagogy of unwellness, we are usually assuming that our students are well and our instructors are well, and that sickness happens sometimes, occasionally, right? And we, our syllabi make room for those exceptions, like the number of absences you're allowed to have, or you can ask for an extension under, extreme, extenuating circumstances. Those syllabi assume wellness. Well, what does it look like to assume unwellness in the classroom? Well, we got a taste of that in the pandemic. Because we had sudden shared acute unwellness, right? Unwellness became collective in a way that we could all had like similar language to talk about it, we could recognize, which is why I think universities then shifted their policies, right? And essentially created more access, which we used to call pre-pandemic times, accommodations. We still call them accommodations, right? But what happened in the pandemic is accommodations became more the norm, meaning they opened up access for so many people. We relaxed all kinds of policies. Well, we're like several years now after 2020, and I think all those policies have snapped back into place, if not even worse than before. So we didn't actually learn, I think, what we were supposed to learn in the pandemic. But I remember, you know, as these policies were loosening, I remember a lot of my disabled friends and colleagues and community felt very bitter about it, because these were access needs that they had been asking from institutions for their entire lives and not getting them, because the exceptions they were asking were too much somehow. Their need was too much. It was not rigorous, or not allowing the classrooms to function the way they're supposed to function, right? And suddenly now everyone's getting those accommodations. But they also felt hope, because, oh, maybe now we recognize that everybody needs things. And look, it doesn't break the classroom to suddenly provide all kinds of care or leniency or flexibility, right? We can actually still do things like learning in a classroom with different kinds of policies. Like I said, that hope kind of died about a year or 2 years later as we started trying to go back to normal. Well, I didn't go back to normal. So what became very clear to me, like I knew students were unwell before the pandemic, right? I was already doing mental health work. But when I came face to face with how unwell because of the pandemic, then I realized, wait, I think they might have been this unwell before too, in different ways, like not dealing with a global pandemic, but dealing with all kinds of awfulness in their lives. Why don't we do this on a normal basis, the things that we're doing now, right? Why didn't we do it before? And that completely changed my teaching, because I couldn't come up with a good reason why I wasn't doing these things before. Rigor is never an answer that made sense to me in the ways that we kind of traditionally or normatively define rigor, because I'm still doing cool things in my classroom and while caring for students during the pandemic. So like you mentioned, I annotate my own syllabus in this chapter, which was actually quite painful at first. So I took a syllabus of mine before the pandemic, and I was like, what was I actually doing before the pandemic? Because I changed a bunch of shit, right? In 2020, we all had to change our syllabi. So I changed a bunch of shit, but I went back and looked, and I was like, oh my God, I have all these policies that I now would never force upon my students because I'm recognizing they're unwell now. And essentially I read my own syllabi for filth. Like I went through and looked for the ableism with totally new eyes, because as a professor teaching disability studies, you would think that I would know what ableism looked like because that's what I teach. But no, I actually did not know what it looked like in the classroom until I intentionally started close reading my own syllabus. And so I do all of that publicly in the book so that people can see, one, what it looks like, where ableism is hidden inside our syllabi in ways that we don't realize. But also, I want it to be a model of vulnerability. Like, look, if I, somebody who supposedly is an expert on ableism, was doing all this ableist shit, right? Jim Lee, a mutual friend of ours, says that I should call myself a recovering ableist, right? I'm a recovering ableist in the classroom. It's okay that you were doing this before as well. Like, we are all invested in ableism and meritocracy, right? Let's undo that together. Let's unlearn that together. And I'm hoping that my model in the book allows people to take that kind of scary step, and one that's probably filled with a lot of shame as well, right? The resistance is probably because you feel ashamed. I know plenty of disability studies scholars who feel ashamed of their past syllabi as they are also going on a journey of figuring out how to better support students and better support themselves, right? So I wanted to model that it's okay to make mistakes and to learn, and that this is a process of learning, and that it's a valuable and needed process, because we need to think of the classroom now as a space of care and not just as a space of achievement or excellence, right? Or productivity, but of one where we are all trying to help each other survive. And part of learning is also doing that as well.
You hacked your own syllabus. I mean, that's what, right? I mean, I find that to be extremely helpful. And I have looked back over my old pre-pandemic syllabi. And just like you, it's like, wow, I can't believe I used to think that was super important.
Yeah, priorities totally shift, right?
Yeah, it has. And so I think for me at least, there's a lot more room to grow in that regard. But yeah, I think all of us should be looking at our previous syllabi anyway, right? To make sure that
Yeah, exactly.
we're adapting
This
and
should
changing. And
be a regular process, right?
that's
Because
right.
we're always learning how to teach better. Hopefully better, not worse, right? Hopefully we're learning to teach better.
Getting
And
better, right?
so,
Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Okay. So last question, and it's kind of an annoying one, but I always like to know, what are you working on now, or what do you hope to be working on? I mean, I know that kind of goes against what you're talking about with productivity and everything, but I want to know what exciting things are, happening in your mind, or are you thinking about?
Exciting things that are happening in my mind. No, I'm going to refuse to answer your question. So I am not working on anything except I am also still working all the time, right? That's the contradiction, meaning I'm not focusing on a new project or anything like that. But my life is filled with labor. And the labor that I am laboring right now, doing right now, is actually really focused on the book tour for this book, which is something that's amazing and awful at the same time, right? Like, I am actually deeply resentful about how much I have to hustle, right? And go talk about this book, because that's a lot of work, right? I'm writing a book about like letting go of our attachments to productivity and work and be lazy. And I'm not allowed to be lazy about how this book enters the world. So much of my energy is going into that. But what I am trying to do for myself is recognize it as labor so that I don't feel like I'm not doing anything, but I'm not working on some new project, right? That I know I have a very limited capacity of energy, of spoons. How do I spread it across all of this real labor that I'm doing, talking about the book, traveling a lot over the next 2 months? How do I take care of myself? How do I figure out new structures of care under these new structural conditions of having to travel and talk about the book so much? So yeah, that's the work. And how do I continue, being a good parent during that? That's always the work that I'm thinking about, right?
That's a great answer, and I'm glad you didn't answer it the way the expectation behind it. So the book is out. When is the publication date? It is
March 26th.
okay. So in a little less than a month, and if people are interested in catching you, I think you're going to several places, all over the country. If people are interested in catching you in person somewhere, they can go to your. Do you have a website?
I have a website that's just my name, mimicook.com.
Okay.
And I have my full book tour up there with details. Hopefully people can catch me in person. I also have a couple of virtual ones for people who can't catch me in person. And I really want people to come out because I want to be in community and conversation with people. I want people to take care of me too in during this tour. So yeah, I want to be in spaces of community and care during this.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mimi, for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. This was lovely.